Good morning. And the second reading this morning is taken from Mark chapter 5, excuse me, verse 21 to 43. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so she'll be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She'd suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him, and he turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered. "And yet you can ask who touched me?" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some of the people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. And he went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately, the little girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. And he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. This is the gospel of the Lord.
Well, good morning. My name is Andre, and it's a great joy to be able to bring you God's word today. I've worked as a doctor now for over 20 years, most of this time as a GP. It is a great privilege to be able to work in a field where you help people all day and to make a living out of it. I see people in some of their most difficult and also some of their most joyous times in their life. People ask me a whole number of questions. One of them is, "Doctor, am I going to die?" I never quite know how to answer that question. Another question that people ask me is, "Isn't modern medicine wonderful?" Well, yes, it is wonderful compared to the past, but not as wonderful as it will be in the future. My passion is preventative health. It's good to cure disease. It's even better to prevent it in the first place. We have a life expectancy these days of about 80 to 85 years. And it is my joy and my pleasure to be able to help people to meet this goal. But there's a problem. They still die. I can't do anything about this. I would say it's beyond my scope of practice. I can do a lot of good, but I have limits. So we're in our sermon series in the book of Mark. As Trev mentioned last week, the Bible's got four biographies written about Jesus: Matthew, Luke, John, Mark. Mark's the first of the biographies that was written perhaps only 37 years after the events actually occurred. Matthew and John are disciples of Jesus. Luke's this doctor history buff who's writing for his mate Theophilus. And Mark is a wealthy Greek-speaking Jew that hangs out with Peter, another one of Jesus' disciples. Mark writes a bare-bones authentic account of Jesus' life. It's the shortest of the four accounts. It's like he's trying to paint a picture with the least possible brushstrokes. If it wasn't for the colour, beauty and power coming from the words that Jesus actually said and the things he did, you could be forgiven for thinking that this was the no-frills version. That's what I love about Mark. It's pure Jesus. So we're halfway through Mark 5. Trev started us back last week. I thought it might be a good time to do a recap. The first four and a half chapters. Chapter 1. Jesus has a heavy first day. He gets baptized by his cousin John, calls a couple of followers, starts preaching at the synagogue in Capernaum, then drives out one spirit who immediately tells people who he is, the Holy One of God. After sunset, Jesus sets up a sick and demon-possessed walk-in clinic where practically the whole town turns up. That's day one. Then heal, exercise, teach, repeat throughout Galilee. He heals the leper. The leper puts on an advertising campaign, and before you know it, Jesus has to go into the wilderness, into Whoop Whoop, to do his work because he gets mobbed in the cities. Then chapter 2, Jesus enters Capernaum again and people crowd around him again. He sees the lame man's greatest need. In front of everyone, forgives his offenses against God, something only God can do. And then he proves what he can do by doing something that everyone can see. Get up, take your mat and walk. And he walks. Calls some followers. He hangs out with sinners. He messes with the Pharisees' head when it comes to what is holy and what is not. In fact, in such a short period of time, chapter 3, Jesus has become such a threat to the religious and the political leaders as the Pharisees and the Herodians, who the two groups who are by no means friends, they unite in a plot to kill Jesus. Jesus sets up a lakeside clinic where half of Galilee turns up for treatment by touching him and again has to tell the demons to stop telling everyone who he is. Then Jesus changes gears. He calls in the cavalry, a posse of 12 trainees to multiply what he's doing, preaching and casting out demons by 12. Chapter 4. Jesus starts lakeside lectures from a boat. He preaches in parables, pithy agricultural and everyday vignettes, aimed at disrupting their paradigm about the plans and the purposes of God for his people. Time for an excursion with his mates, again by boat, which gets rudely interrupted by severe weather, which nearly sinks their boat. A furious storm. Jesus gets up, and with two words, the storm stops. Does he have a limit? Chapter 5, almost forgot. Chapter 5, he gets to the foreigner side of the lake and we meet the most demon-possessed of the demon-possessed. He's like the heavyweight champion of the demon-possessed world. How many demons does this guy have? No idea. But we do know he calls himself Legion, which is between 3,000 and 5,000 Roman soldiers. And Jesus doesn't even have to cast the demons out. There's no contest. Like Trev said last week, this is King Jesus, the strong one. They beg Jesus to let them stay local, and he gives them permission to enter 2,000 pigs. Does he have a limit? Now we pick up the action in our section today of one woman and one girl. Jesus gets back to the side of the lake where he came from, and instantly the crowd is back in verse 21. Then of all people, verse 22, an influential man serving at the synagogue named Jairus has a desperate plea, falls at the knees of Jesus, pleads with him to come and lay his hands on his little girl who's dying. Terrible situation. What's his deep desire? Save my girl. Verse 23, Verse 23, please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. So Jesus goes, but on the way he's hemmed in by another big crowd pressing around him. Then verse 25, a woman who suffered blood loss for 12 years approaches behind Jesus. In medical terms, she had severe chronic menorrhagia, possibly from fibroids, probably associated with some form of pain. It's painful. Menorrhagia itself is a very common condition. It's very personal. It can be very difficult. The bleeding commonly causes iron deficiency with chronic tiredness and can lead to anemia and other complications. Today we have iron infusions, blood transfusions. We have imaging to work out whether or not it's cancerous. We could do a biopsy. There are hormonal treatments, there's surgical treatments. We can actually stop the bleeding. Not so for this woman. The more she paid her local doctors, the worse it got. Not only was she suffering from the blood loss for 12 years, she was suffering from the poverty because she'd used up all of her money to pay for this treatment. The great shame of it was that none of it worked. Now she could add poverty to her original problem. So what's her deep desire? Stop this bleeding. The crowds wanted to touch Jesus. She didn't. In verse 28, she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. But why? Chapter 3, verse 10, for he's healed many so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Chapter 5, verse 23, we've just read, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she may be healed and live. The crowds wanted to touch Jesus to be healed. Jairus asked Jesus to touch his little daughter to be healed. Why not this woman? What's so different about her? It was her shame. She's unclean, and in the Jewish tradition, because of her bleeding, she's been this way for 12 years. Leviticus 15 explains this. It talks of the ritual uncleanness of men and women with discharge. Verse 25 says, when a woman has a discharge of blood for many days at a time, other than her monthly period, or has a discharge that continues beyond her period, she will be unclean as long as she has the discharge. This means she has no temple access, as ceremonially unclean people cannot visit the temple, so she can't worship God. She can't even touch anyone because they become unclean as well. This is hard stuff. Occasionally we have a medical condition which might mean that we have to take some time out of our life. Can't go to work, can't go to school, can't spend time with family or friends. Might be a cold, could take you out of your life for 3 or 4 days. Could be the flu, could take you out of your life for a week. It could be some other unmentionable virus. This disease took this lady out for 12 years. Imagine not being with your family, your friends, your community for 12 years. She's an outcast. She's lost everything. She's got no money. She's got no people. No way to worship God. Like a cursed, unworthy, invisible person you wouldn't even make eye contact with on the side of the road. And if I could just touch his clothes, maybe just the edge of his cloak, that's all I need. So she did. And in verse 29, immediately everything is reversed. Bleeding is stopped. And it says she felt in her body she was freed from her suffering. Verse 29. Then Jesus stopped. It's at this point you have to ask yourself the question, why? She's already been healed. It can't be to heal her. He's urgently needing to go and heal and help this dying girl. Very serious situation. So why does he stop? Why does he turn around here? Notice what he says in the next verse, verse 30. Not who touched me. He never asked that. Although even the disciples naturally thought he did, if you look in verse 31. No, he asked, who touched my clothes? Do you see that? Who touched my clothes. The real question is, who deliberately touched my clothes instead of touching me? That is an astonishing question. Imagine the discussion that Mark would have had with Peter at this point. Mark writing things down, and Peter either dictating it or having had many discussions with him. Look at the extraordinary detail that Mark includes in the narrative in verse 30, giving us a glimpse into the inner workings of Jesus when he heals and what it feels like when he heals. Fascinating. But even more powerful than this is the whole reason Jesus is calling this woman out in the first place. You see, she wanted to be healed in secret because of her shame. But he wanted to heal her from her shame. So he calls her out in verse 30. Who touched my clothes? Verse 32, Jesus keeps looking for the person. And finally in verse 33, the woman, terrified, falls at his feet. She confesses the whole truth. So what does he do? He restores her place in her community. He gives her dignity by declaring in front of everyone she is healed and thus fit to participate in her life again. And what heals her? He doesn't even say, I healed you, or you have been healed. He says in verse 34, daughter, your faith, that is your trust in me, has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. He didn't just heal her pain. He healed her shame. Then he calls her daughter. In the four biographies of Jesus, guess how many people Jesus calls daughter. It's one. It's this woman, and it's here. Luke confirms this. Then he says, go in peace, which is a formula for the Hebrew word shalom. This is a peace, not just a freedom from worries, but a completeness of life that comes from being brought into a right relationship with God. His stopping and calling restores her dignity. She is renewed after 12 years of torment. She is part of a community again. She is at peace and finally back in the communion of temple worship with God. So I ask again, does Jesus have any limits? Feels like you need a break there, doesn't it? But you don't get one, because in rapid fire, we get the next turn of events. Jairus, the synagogue leader, was there when Jesus was speaking to this long-suffering woman. When in verse 35, we hear the worst news a parent can hear. Your daughter is dead. The contrast here between these two lives desperately needing Jesus on this day, at this time, could not be more stark. 12 years ago, a woman's suffering took away her life, and today she is restored to pure joy. 12 years ago, a bundle of joy was brought into this life, and today it's taken away, and her parents are suffering. Yet Jesus' actions here shows he cares just as much for a poor outcast on the fringe of society as he does for a daughter from a privileged background. What unites them? Faith, trust. Jesus points out to them the key to accessing their deepest desire is trusting in him. The woman had enough faith that just the touch of his cloak was enough, as Jesus points out in verse 34. Then in rapid fire, blinking, you'd miss it in verse 35, while Jesus is still speaking, and he had just spoken those beautiful words to the woman, Jairus hears his daughter is dead. And then in verse 36, Jesus ignores the bearers of bad news and turns to Jairus and says, don't be afraid, just believe. Now, these words at this point might not have made much sense to a shocked, grieving father, but Jesus is asking him to trust me and take me at my word. So then Jesus takes his inner circle with him to the loudest house in the neighborhood in verse 38. Then Jesus, in a gentle and beautiful way, tells them what he's going to do in verse 39. The child is not dead, but asleep. Then he gathers the parents and his inner group around the girl, and in front of them, he takes her little hand, it's probably cold by then, and says in Aramaic, verse 41, Talitha kum, little girl, get up. Immediately, the dead body sprang to life. She got up and walked around just like she suddenly woke up. Then in verse 43, Jesus gives some very sensible advice about making sure she's got something to eat. And by the way, don't tell anyone about this. Yes, this 12-year-old girl is alive again. But this is normal, ordinary life. There's no prizes for guessing what will happen if she doesn't have food, have water. Well, she runs the risk of dying again. So what does this all mean for us today? Well, we learn three things about Jesus. Number one, Jesus superheals. What was the woman's desire? To have her bleeding healed. And Jesus not only heals her bleeding, but restores her dignity. What's the synagogue ruler's desire? To heal his gravely sick daughter. She was not restored from her illness. She was restored from death to complete health. Jesus meets their desire, completely fulfills it, and then some. Then he finds their deepest desire, even things that they did not think possible and would never have thought to ask, and fulfills that. First, this gives us great comfort because not only does it teach us he can heal our pain, but he can take away your shame. And it doesn't matter how deep your scar is, how painful your wounds are, how secret your addiction is, or how you blame yourself for unmentionable things that have happened. He can heal your pain and he can take away your shame. You see, friends, Jesus superheals. He can heal over and above what we ask for. It doesn't mean he's going to give us everything that we want. He's not a vending machine in the sky. Like C.S. Lewis writes about the Christ figure Aslan from Narnia, he's not a tame lion. He makes up his own mind. The point here is to dare, to have the vulnerability to engage with God on a deep level with the things that mean the most to you. Now, I'm a cricket tragic. My favourite batter is Stephen Smith, and everything he does is larger than life. His batting average is larger than life. His cover drive is larger than life. Even the way he stands in the crease. His calling with his partner is larger than life as well. When there's no run, he says, "No run!" And when he's not sure, he says, "Wait on!" And then if there is a run, he says, "Yep, yep, 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 yep." Nicky Gumbel says about how these three calls in cricket are like the three answers that God has for our prayers. A yes is simple. You pray, he answers it. You give thanks, you glorify him. The wait call and the no call sound the same. So we wait. We keep praying. This can be very hard. What are we supposed to do? Keep trusting. Keep believing. Sometimes there is no answer to our prayers, but God might do something completely unexpected and marvelous, like healing your relationship with that estranged family member. Or the person that is least expected to become a believer becomes one on their deathbed. Or you might receive relief from grief and shame that has troubled you for years. How much more blessed is it if you prayed for it? And why would you pray? Because you know Jesus superheals. Number two, faith beyond death. Mark's account shows Jesus introducing for the first time a faith beyond death. Because when is it that he tells the synagogue ruler Jairus to believe? Was it before his little girl died or after? It was after she died. Jesus here first promotes a faith beyond death. He asks us to trust him even if our requests go unanswered. To trust him in the worst circumstances, even when you think he's let you down. Why? Because he is faithful and he can do anything. In my opinion, Jesus presents the most credible reason for faith beyond death. Jesus demonstrated his mastery over death by raising this girl to life, which was witnessed by others, who then went on to dictate their accounts for posterity. Luke and Mark record these accounts in their biographies. These are eyewitness accounts from Peter and possibly other disciples we're reading. Based on their evidence alone, we have reason for our trust in Jesus beyond death. And thirdly, salvation. We have just some hints that there is more to come. The woman is told by Jesus, "Daughter, your faith has healed you." The word for healed in Greek here is sesoken, which also means saved. So when Jesus addresses the woman he has just healed, he implies he's not just a healing from her illness, but a salvation. Remember, he super heals her into being in a right relationship with God. This fits nicely with the next thing he says, shalom, the completeness that comes from being in a right relationship with God. And then the girl, he rises from the dead, only to die another day. And by the way, give her something to eat. And don't tell anyone I've done this. Shh, not yet. You can see what he's doing, can't you? Everything he's doing is pointing to what is to come. Like I said earlier, I'm grateful for my work. I treat menorrhagia, and I've resuscitated people. What I can't do is raise people from the dead so as to never die again. For that, we need divine intervention, which is exactly what Jesus specializes in. What is the deepest human desire? It is to commune with the eternal. Ecclesiastes 3:10. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. In our deepest being, there is a yearning to know God and to live life eternal. And Jesus makes both possible. Jesus, the one who has no limit, defeats sin so we can personally know God, and death so we can live life eternal, disarming the powers and authorities, making a public spectacle of them, says Colossians 2, on the cross. We will have to wait a little bit longer to get to that part. Read ahead if you can't wait. So friends, in the cut and thrust of life, don't forget Jesus, because he can super heal over and above your expectation. Be bold and trust in him with a faith that goes beyond death, because he is faithful and his power is not limited by death. And don't forget his unfinished business with death, sin, and the ultimate victory of resurrection, defeating all his enemies and laying them at his feet. Don't be afraid, just believe.